For Connecticut Public Radio, I'm John Henry Smith. The United States Supreme Court today made a decision that is sure to change the college sports landscape as we know it. Now, that, of course, includes our college athletic programs right here in the state of Connecticut. Here to discuss today's ruling is Mark Edelman. He's a professor at Baruch College, as well as an expert in sports antitrust law. He's been following this case very closely. He's written a number of articles about it in different publications, including an article today in Forbes magazine. Mark, kids generate millions of dollars for the grown-ups who run the NCAA and Division I schools. Is it correct to say that the NCAA in this case was arguing, hey, we should not have to treat our student-athletes with the same rules and protections enjoyed by conventional employees because college sports are special? And the Supreme Court responded, no, you're not.
That is exactly correct. In fact, the concurring opinion coming from Justice Kavanaugh, the very last sentence, in essence said what you had just said word for word, that the NCAA might be a joint venture, that its restraints might be subject to the rule of reason, just like any other joint venture, but they still have to follow the law, just like any other collection of businesses in this country.
Okay, so let's get back to that idea that this is going to change college sports forever. How do you think it will change things for the biggest, highest-level programs in this state, of course, that would be UConn?
Okay. Well, we have both short-term impacts of this ruling and longer-term impacts of this ruling. Now, all that the ruling explicitly stated, if you look at the holding itself, is that colleges cannot collectively get together and prevent any other college within the NCAA from offering educational benefits to their athletes in any amount they want. So the immediate change is UConn has historically had a very good basketball program, and UConn might wish to have an even more successful basketball program. And historically, there's been a limit on what type of educational benefits UConn or any other school is supposed to be allowed to provide their athletes. Now, let's say that there is a high school student who's a tremendous basketball player, who the University of Connecticut feels would be a good fit for their school and a good fit for the basketball program. Effective immediately, if the University of Connecticut wants to try to recruit that athlete to the basketball program by offering them things tethered to education, for example, a computer, or the ability without paying to study abroad in a study abroad program, or even free education for life at the University of Connecticut. UConn can do that, and the NCAA cannot seek to punish UConn in any way for offering the athletes these type of benefits. And that's the short term. The long term, which is very interesting, is that if you read the ruling closely, there are a number of other restraints that are imposed by the NCAA on a national level that were not challenged directly in this ruling, but if you look at the language, might, based upon the economic impact, be found down the road to be illegal as well. So it's possible in the long run we'll see athletes at the University of Connecticut also being able to make money by endorsing products, and perhaps in subsequent court decisions based upon the precedent struck here, we might see some of the national restraints on direct cash payments to college athletes erode over time as well.
So is the University of Connecticut, would you say, and other Division I schools, are they happy about this ruling? Are they upset about this ruling, would you say, or somewhere in the middle?
Those who are going to be most opposed would be the presidents, the athletic directors, and the coaches at these schools. And the reason why some of these people would be opposed is, you know, the revenues that come in from college sports, while colossal, are pretty much fixed. And college programs like UConn are nonprofit institutions, so you don't have shareholders. What that means is in a world where nothing beyond the cost of education goes to the athlete itself, if you don't have shareholders, the money needs to go somewhere. And that's why we have this bizarre system of college presidents at big-time athletic programs making many million dollars per year and athletic directors making many millions of dollars per year, and sometimes even college football and men's basketball coaches earning more money than their NFL and NBA counterparts. Well, if this begins to change, and even a small amount of the revenue derived from college sports is shifted to the labor, shifted to the athletes themselves, well, maybe that leads to a little bit less of the pie being available for these other people who already make well into the seven figures. And to the extent we have a college president or an athletic director or a coach who is simply greedy or self-interested by nature, they are going to be very opposed to a rule that might mean the players get a little bit, and thus they get a little bit less.
You know, a program like UConn that has a football team, but not one that competes at the highest levels and brings in the type of revenues that, say, University of Alabama's football team does. I know football is very much a driver for so many of these athletic programs. So when you have a school that, UConn's run in the red, you know, for quite a few years, their athletic program, and they don't have that football revenue necessarily to add on. So if they have to keep up with other schools to, say, offer, as you say, lifetime education, or if they have to keep up with other schools for other benefits, so does that further exacerbate the haves versus the have-nots in college sports, or no?
I'm not sure if it would, for a few reasons. First, you're presuming that UConn is going to make the decision to continue to keep up. Nothing requires them to offer these additional forms of compensation. They could let some of their competitor schools do it. But if you think about things from the perspective of the college athlete, the NCAA keeps on crying that this is going to increase the discrepancy between the haves and have-nots. Economic knowledge points in the other direction, if anything. To illustrate this point, if you look at the University of Alabama football depth chart, and you look at quarterback one through quarterback six on the depth chart, every single one of them could be a starter at most colleges. They've all chosen Alabama because they think it's the best program where they'll get the best coaching, where if they make it, they'll get the most attention, and there's no financial inducement to go anywhere. Now, if we change the system so that someone who would be quarterback six on the depth chart at University of Alabama might be quarterback one on the depth chart at the University of Connecticut. And while number six might not be that important to Alabama, so they do not want to throw additional benefits at that athlete, number one would be very beneficial to the University of Connecticut. The University of Connecticut actually might be willing to make a greater package, a better package to that athlete. And that shouldn't be surprising, because if we look at higher education for a moment, and we want to be honest with ourselves, we don't see the top 1,000 professors in the country, based on any attribute to rank them, all locked up at Harvard and Penn and Princeton. The reality is there are plenty of very good state schools like the University of Connecticut that have certain very good professors there, because the school might decide that having someone to be the star in a particular market or part industry is important to them. And the University of Connecticut might pay more for someone to be the chair of a certain academic program than Harvard would pay for them to be the 30th D professor in that area. And I think we'll see something similar begin to emerge in the area of collegiate athletics.
We've talked a lot about the University of Connecticut as being one of the higher profile, if not the highest profile, college program in the state. But of course, there are many others: Yale, Central Connecticut State, Sacred Heart, just to name a few. How are programs like that, where they have not been competing for the absolute cream of the crop when it comes to athletic ability among the high school potential high school entrants, and might not have to worry about things like making sure that athletes are able to take advantage of their likeness and image to profit from them. What are schools like Yale, Central Connecticut, Sacred Heart, how are they feeling about today's ruling?
Let's talk about Yale, because Yale is so interesting to me. I had studied at the University of Pennsylvania, and the ancient eight colleges, the Ivy League colleges, are so interesting because they have maintained amongst themselves restraints on college athlete compensation that are greater even than the NCAA rules. When the NCAA liberalized their rules in 1951 to allow for full academic scholarships, the eight colleges that are part of the Ivy League, which includes Yale, continued to maintain this rule that will have financial need, but we won't give athletic scholarships. The reason why the Ivy League, and I believe the Patriot League as well, these schools have been able to continue to compete against the larger college athletic programs while giving less economically, is as a core benefit. At the end of the day, if a student takes their education seriously, the learning that comes from going to a school like Yale has real value to it. And even leaving aside what takes place in the classroom, a Yale graduate has access to an academic network and has a diploma with a pedigree behind it that he or she could use for the rest of his or her life in a way that's distinctly unique. So for the standpoint of a school like Yale, I don't know if they need to offer more than what they do to compete for an elite athlete. They already have the unique proposition in terms of offering top-notch academics as a way of inducing a certain segment of the community. It becomes a lot more interesting when you start turning to the schools out there, and I'm not going to use any school by name, but when you start turning to the schools that take a lot of pride in their athletics to self-marketing, that do not necessarily offer cream-of-the-crop education, that do not necessarily offer the most desirable or exciting location to be, and now when they're only treading water and able to keep successful athletics when no one could offer anyone anything, now they are going to really have to think about what they could do to compete for athletes to stay ahead in the process when they're not offering anything else that would be a distinct attribute to make them desirable to students.
For the dyed-in-the-wool college sports fan here in Connecticut and elsewhere, what in the next 3 to 5 years are they most likely to notice about the way the game and the game on and off the field, mostly off the field actually, has changed because of today's ruling?
Well, the ruling does not explicitly mention name, image, and likeness in any which way. The low-hanging fruit, I have believed, for a long period of time was to bring an antitrust challenge to prevent the NCAA from stopping athletes from making money from third-party payments. And even the NCAA, alongside this ruling today, seems to reluctantly acknowledge that they cannot try to stop third-party payments anymore in all of the different ways that they've threatened to do so. I don't think anyone will notice the difference per se from today's decision that certain athletes have computers that are given to them by UConn or by Yale when they wouldn't before. But I think the real change we're going to start seeing over the next few years is that when you see an ad for things like Nike or for Reebok, you might have a college athlete endorsing the product, which means that the college athletes themselves in some ways will become even more famous. And interestingly, if we think about college football and college basketball, the athletes skewed towards low-income populations. They're disproportionately African-American because black, sadly, is still a proxy for poor in many cases in this country. And many of them would really like to continue with their education, but the NCAA rules prevented them from earning money and precluded them from doing so. So I think the really interesting thing we'll see is we might see some superstar athletes in football and basketball who are now able to sign endorsement deals, make a little bit of money to help themselves and their family members out, and maybe we'll see less one and done. Maybe we'll see, because they're able to earn a good income and lock up certain third-party benefits while in school, maybe there'll be a greater incentive to stick around and graduate.
That's a very interesting point, especially when you consider, like, the NBA has the G League now, and you've got the saga of players going into the G League straight from high school, and you know, two or three of them are going to be drafted this year in the NBA draft. So that in and of itself sort of puts pressure on college sports. And so you're saying that this could be in some way a tonic for that, not necessarily a curing tonic, but something that would help college athletic programs compete in that landscape.
No, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, a lot of athletes probably would go and play in college sports. Not only are going to the G League, but in many cases they're doing things that would seem very out of character, moving to Australia, moving to China, in the case of Jeremy Tyler, moving to Israel, all for the opportunity to be able to sign endorsement deals and make some money. If the restraint comes off and those economic deterrents to college go away, I think we might see the NCAA again more able to compete for the top athletes, especially from the lower socioeconomic levels.
Very interesting stuff. Mark Edelman of Baruch College, thank you so much for the insights.
My pleasure. Have a good afternoon.